I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney.
And this is BusinessWise. Our guests today are Palmyra and Dave Buten. Palmyra and Dave are the creators of an amazing game called the Budget Challenge. This is really more than a game. This is really a financial education tool that schools and children can use to really learn real-time money issues.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, Palmyra and I met in business school at IU, and you know, we started out looking at houses and stuff, and we were kind of mind-blown because we thought we had a good education in business. And the two of us together, we thought buying a house wouldn't be that difficult. We didn't think we'd be learning that much. But we sat down at the dinner table, and we're like, I can't believe that we learned as much as we did today. We actually thought about how do other people figure this stuff out? And that's sort of where the seed started for this idea. We've always had an entrepreneurial spirit, but then when we realized that there's really a need for people to figure this stuff out, we started really figuring out some of the groundwork for this business.
Well, and you both had financial backgrounds, right? You both have MBAs, so you would think you would already know that.
Not to mention, Palmyra went to Harvard. Dave, you had your undergraduate at Purdue. Mm-hmm. I mean, you folks are very well educated.
Well, we thought we were, and we were just surprised at like all the things we were learning, and like we actually thought like maybe most people never actually figure it out.
So it's not intuitive. Money matters generally are not intuitive. They don't teach it in school, or at least they haven't historically. But you all are about to change all that.
Yes, I think this kind of learning really takes practice, and you have to experience it. It's kind of like riding a bike. You can't just see a PowerPoint or talk about it. You actually have to do it. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of what this game is all about. It's immersing them in the scenario where they have to pay bills and they have to save.
Well, let's talk about that. So Tom and I have a daughter. She grew up on computer games, the kind where you had to make choices and your actions had a consequence. It's kind of the same thing as the budget challenge.
Yes, that's right. In the classroom, the students can compete against their peers. They get a score, and the way the scoring works is they earn points by saving, and they lose points every time they make a mistake. They incur fees or they miss paying a bill. So
it's a lot better to learn that lesson on a computer game than in real life.
Well, absolutely. We like to think of budget challenges like financial training wheels. So, you know, there's going to be a lot of mistakes people make. But if you do it in an environment that isn't going to cost you, you know, points on your credit score or lots of money in bank fees, we feel this is a better way to learn for a lot of young people.
What kind of settings do you use budget challenge in? I mean, where is it best shown?
We've actually had this used in a lot of different environments. I mean, public schools, private schools, even expatriate schools, charter schools, homeschools, colleges, boys and girls clubs, and church youth groups have all used Budget Challenge.
And what kind of feedback are you getting, and are you seeing any results?
They love it. And actually, what's really surprising is how emotionally invested the students get, because they get really happy when they get a pay raise. Mm-hmm. They get upset when they don't have enough money to pay.
Just like real life.
Exactly. So we really like how they kind of take it to heart.
What age groups is this targeted to?
We target high school students or also college students.
I don't know about your first day on college, you know, college campus, but I remember trying to figure out which T-shirt I liked the best, you know, to figure out where I was going to bank. I know I would appreciate it, a bit of role play before I was actually put in that situation.
And our goal is kind of to reach those students before they're on their own. Mm-hmm. So they have kind of a safety net where they can talk to their teachers or their parents about these contracts, about the rules, and understand the terminology, because so many of them have never heard of a 401k.
But if folks would like to learn more about the Budget Challenge, what's your website?
www.budgetchallenge.com.
For BusinessWise, I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney. We're with Cooney, Faulkner & Stevens, your business advocate. I'm Tom Cooney.
And I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And this is BusinessWise. Today, our guests are Palmyra and David Buten, and they are the creators of a financial literacy game called the Budget Challenge. How many schools have adopted it now?
We are in 65 schools across 20 states.
In the state of Ohio, for the children who will be graduating in 2014 from high school, mm-hmm. they are required to have certain key elements of financial education taught to them. The problem is there's really no specific definition of how those five concepts are taught. Many high school children would never have experienced these concepts, not for the game.
That's correct. And we really try to make it as real as possible. We make it run in real time, which is something that's kind of a foreign concept to a lot of them. Mm-hmm. It keeps going during vacation. It happens.
Just like real life.
Just like real life. And they actually have to go through the actions of paying bills and saving and doing everything as they would in real life.
But you make it fun, too, don't you? So they'll actually do the game as opposed to trying to create a budget, which nobody really wants to do.
That's right. We actually have a unique scoring system that ranks the students within a class against each other. And there's a nice, you know, healthy competition within the class. We also have school versus school or class versus class competitions to make things even more interesting. And these classes can be, you know, like crosstown rivals or even, you know, we've had a class in Alaska that was in one of our inter-school competitions.
But just think about that, right? If you've got our next generation of adults, and they all are being rewarded for making good financial choices, and that's becoming part of their common sense. That's wonderful.
It is, and like I know that when I learned this stuff, there wasn't as much or many different tools or ways of doing things. I can pay things through a phone. I can go through the website. I can do things in person. And there's all sorts of things that I figured out over a long time. But someone that's learning this right now has a lot more to learn than I think anyone has ever had to learn.
Maybe you can share just quickly any unusual things that a normal high school student would not typically have in their everyday life.
Well, right now, all of the transactions on our website are online, so they can access all of their accounts and see their current status. They can see their bank account. They can make online payments. They can interact with us like they would with customer service. So if, like, for example, if we plant an error to see if they're mm-hmm. paying attention, they can write to us.
What about things like insurance and things like that? How do you teach a child about that?
We have options at the very beginning of the game. So within every budget category, for example, with the car insurance, one option has a high deductible and a lower premium, and the other is vice versa. We talk about, for the car loan, a credit union versus a bank loan, and they have to decide what works best for them.
And one of the curveballs we sometimes throw students is we simulate a car crash in the game. So we'll actually send out a bill for deductible, or we might not. But if you are in a car crash and you have the high deductible, you should have, you know, planned for that and used your budget to be, you know, be ready for that bill in case it happens.
The other thing I really think was pretty interesting is you have built in fees for overdrafting your checking account, just like real life. I mean, there's some severe consequences if you do that. Until you do it, you don't know about those.
Yeah, and we replicate that in our game. So, for example, if you overdraw your bank account, you would get a, you know, NSF fee from the bank. At the same time, the place that you were trying to pay a bill to, that vendor would also assess you a return check fee. And if the time lag in all of this caused you to be late, you might get a late fee on top of that for the bill you were trying to pay originally.
If people would like information, or a school or parents would like to learn more, what's your website?
www.budgetchallenge.com.
For BusinessWise, I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney. We're with Cooney, Faulkner & Stevens, your business advocate.
I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney.
And this is BusinessWise. You know, Tom, there's a saying that you shouldn't mix business with pleasure, but I'm happy to say that you may be able to mix business travel and still get some personal pleasure out of it.
And get a tax deduction.
And get a tax deduction.
Which can be pleasurable in and of itself.
So the question then is, what rules, what criteria do you need to comply with so that you can turn your vacation into a tax deduction?
Well, generally, your business travel, in order for it to be a business expense, your days spent on business have to be at least 50% of the days.
So in other words, the primary purpose of your trip needs to be business related. But if you tack on a few days of personal fun, that won't necessarily deny the tax deduction for the business portion of it. So if you fly somewhere, for example, to go on a business trip, the airplane costs, the hotel, the one half of the meals, other incidentals like taxis, those are all deductible as business expenses.
Yes, if it's a business trip and you're spending at least half your time on business and you can take your family along, they don't have to spend their time on business. You can't deduct the incremental cost of taking them.
Right. So if you and your wife go on a trip, if you were going to spend $200 for a hotel room and she stays there, you can still deduct the entire $200. Now, that is for those business days. To the extent you have personal days after your business is completed, then those will not be eligible for a deduction.
That's right. And the cost of your spouse's meals and entertainment will not be deductible.
Unless your spouse is an employee of your business. And if you and your spouse both work in your own business, for example, then you should be able to deduct the entire cost.
Yeah, as long as they're both doing business.
This also holds true if you're looking for a job. So if you travel out of town to look for a job, and the primary purpose obviously is business related, and again, you tack on a day or two to sightsee, that shouldn't deny you the tax deductibility of those business costs.
Yeah, now those types of expenses, job hunting expenses, are miscellaneous itemized deductions, so not everyone can take advantage of those. It depends upon what else is in your tax return.
The key is really to track everything, make sure you have good documentation, and be reasonable. Make sure that you're not trying to be overzealous in your deductions. Make sure they do sound reasonable, because if you do get audited, then you'll have to be able to prove and substantiate the business purpose and that the costs that you incurred were reasonable.
And the time that you spent on the business.
There are special rules that relate to cruises and international travel. So make sure if you are looking at one of these types of trips that you talk to someone, you engage with people who are knowledgeable in how to maximize your tax deductions so that you can mix your business and travel and let the IRS pay for part of the tab. For BusinessWise, I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney. We're with Cooney, Faulkner & Stevens, your business advocate.
I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney.
And this is BusinessWise. It's every entrepreneur's dream to create a business that grows and prospers and is profitable and just really creates wealth for themselves and their family. But unless you take steps to protect that wealth, protect the assets that you've created, you could unfortunately lose them if you get into a lawsuit, if someone sues you. So the question becomes, how do you grow a business and protect your assets?
Well, and that's also every entrepreneur's nightmare, I think, is losing their business because of some lawsuit or some misstep that happens that causes all the assets to be taken by a creditor.
And, you know, most small business owners don't have the luxury of having in-house lawyers, in-house accountants who can do nothing but watch over them and their business operations every day. But some of the very basic things at the very beginning when you start your company that you should consider in terms of overall asset protection is the type of entity, this type of legal entity that you choose to do business. For example, a sole proprietorship, a partnership, LLC, or corporation.
And it's important to understand and talk to your attorney about the liability implications of each type of entity. Limited liability companies have become very popular, both for business partnerships or what used to be a sole proprietorship is oftentimes now a limited liability company. In many cases, people that own rental property will have their rental property placed into limited liability companies for the liability protection it brings. And certainly you need to talk to your attorney to advise you about that, but also understand the tax implications and the tax reporting implications of that. But just because you've put your assets in a limited liability company doesn't mean you're protected from everything, because you may build up a lot of assets in that limited liability company as well.
And there are also special rules about actually mixing yourself individually into the business operations as opposed to the business entity itself. So you have to be very careful and, like Tom mentioned, speak to attorneys, speak to accountants, albeit outside consultants, who can help you understand what you should and shouldn't do to protect your assets. The worst thing that you could possibly imagine is you spend your entire lifetime building this valuable business only to have someone come along and take it from you. So it's critical that you take the steps necessary to protect your assets. Another very important thing is take a look at your insurance coverage. Make sure you have plenty of insurance in case the unexpected occurs to cover yourself and cover any actions that could be taken against you.
Well, in today's world, technology changes a lot of things in your business. For instance, you may be at risk because you have a lot of personal confidential information of people that could be breached. So make sure you understand your responsibilities with regard to that, the security you have with regard to that, and any liability insurance you may need as a result of that.
You just can't let the day-to-day activities of your operations keep you from taking care of these very important matters. For BusinessWise, I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney. We're with Cooney, Faulkner & Stevens, your business advocate.
I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney.
And this is BusinessWise. Our guests today are Carolyn Roffus. Carolyn is the president of Potter Hill Homes, and she is also the president of the Home Builders Association of Greater Cincinnati. And then joining Carolyn is Dan Dressman, and Dan is the executive director of the Home Builders Association of Greater Cincinnati. And Carolyn, your family's been in the home building business for many years. I'm sure you've seen a lot of different trends. Where do you think trends are going?
Well, at Potter Hill Homes, we're really banking on the fact that people are desiring more energy efficient homes and more compact, smaller floor plans that are still very livable. And so that's the way that we design our houses. For the first time in decades, the average square foot of new construction is actually declining. And so I think, the key phrase that was in the industry just a few short years ago was the McMansion, the big houses that were just getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And with the bubble that popped, I think also the desire for smaller, more affordable homes has started to resurface.
I think that, in fact, nationally, about 20% of the homes that are being built today are considered green-built homes or energy-efficient homes. So there's really, as Carolyn mentioned, it's becoming much more popular.
Well, people are just pinching pennies any which way they can. And, your utility bill in your house is the second largest component of homeownership cost that there is. And so if you can start to cut back on the costs of homeownership itself, then it makes it more affordable.
Well, who's buying these new, somewhat smaller homes?
There's just a trend in general for people to go towards a little bit smaller home these days. Certainly you have young families who want larger houses, but they're not quite as large as what they maybe were 5 or 10 years ago even. So while younger families do want larger homes, they're not quite as large as what they might have been in the past.
With interest rates as low as they are, it allows people to buy more house, in terms of overall cost.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. So, during this storm of the real estate bubble that's popped, the one shining light has been interest rates. And it continues to make homeownership very affordable, especially for people who are confident that their jobs are going to be around, which, not everyone can say. But it really is. You hear that it's a buyer's market. And what that really means is it's very, very affordable. And interest rates are so low that we'll probably never see these rates again in my lifetime.
We hear a lot about foreclosures, although that doesn't seem to be as common as it was for a while. Has that overhang gone away? Is that still affecting the home building industry?
At the board meetings at the Home Builders Association, we often do a round robin and just talk to all the builders that are at the table to see how business is. And I would say one common factor is that everyone considers foreclosures and resale homes as the biggest competition out there. So no longer are builders considering each other the biggest competition. It's really just that foreclosure and resale inventory that just needs to get worked through. I think there needs to be some kind of cautious strategy to not overflood the market with foreclosures, but we do need to get through these. We do need to incentivize people, to get them out of the market and to get homeowners back in them so that we can all be better off.
Dan, where do you see home building industry, the market? Where do you see that going in the next year or so?
Well, I think we're probably going to be continuing to bump along the bottom for the foreseeable future, but I think there's a lot of enthusiasm. I think consumer confidence is definitely picking up. There's a lot of very positive things in the market you already touched on, like interest rates being historically low, some great values on the market right now. One of the best things I've seen recently coming out of the government is a recommendation to allow more investors to purchase foreclosed homes at a quicker process, mm-hmm. and that will hopefully eat through some of those foreclosed homes that are on the market.
For BusinessWise, I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney. We're with Cooney, Faulkner & Stevens, your business advocate. I'm Tom Cooney.
And I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And this is BusinessWise. Today, our guests are Dan Dressman and Carolyn Rolfes. Dan is the executive director of the Home Builders Association of Greater Cincinnati. And Carolyn is the president of the Home Builders Association. And she's also the president of Potter Hill Homes. And I guess you're just finishing up Homerama.
Right.
But that's not the only home show you do, is it?
We have our 11th City-Rama planned in partnership with the City of Cincinnati in the community of Northside, and it's going to be held September 8th through the 16th at a community called Virginia Place.
And Carolyn, I know Potter Hill Homes was really a pioneer developing homes, building homes in urban areas. Do you see a big trend to people moving more towards urban living?
I absolutely do. So this will be our fifth City-Rama that we've participated in, and so we're glad to be back. And I think one of the biggest draws for urban living, is not only people tired of being in their vehicles all the time, especially with the price of gas these days, but also the City of Cincinnati is very progressive with a tax abatement that they offer to new homeowners. So if you build a brand new house in the city limits, you get a 10-year property tax abatement, and the value cap on that escalates every year. So this year, it's about $290,000. So for a period of 10 years, you're not paying property taxes on $290,000 worth of house.
Well, two of the three biggest costs to owning a home, I would think, would be utilities and taxes.
Yeah.
And some of these homes are pretty energy efficient as well, aren't they?
Absolutely. You know, the energy code already requires that new houses are constructed to a better standard than what they used to be. So all new homes are really energy efficient. At Potter Hill Homes, we have gone sort of above and beyond. So we build a lot of houses that are Energy Star certified, which means that they're at least 15% more energy efficient than required by the building code. You know, additionally, we also build a lot of homes that are built to the LEED certification, which is a green built program under the U.S. Green Building Council. And for a LEED built home in the city, you get an extra 5-year tax abatement on top of the 10 years.
You know, what's fascinating to me is we live in the city, and I've heard of the tax abatement, but I don't think many people really realize the magnitude of the savings if they build a home in the city limits.
Yeah, just to run some quick numbers, you know, on a home that costs about $200,000 in the city, you'll be saving about $5,000 or $6,000 each and every year on that house. So if you build just a new house that's not LEED certified, you know, $5,000 or $6,000 over a period of 10 years, that's $50,000 or $60,000. And then you get an extra 5 years if the home is built to LEED certification.
So you don't have to be a CPA to figure out that's a pretty good deal, right? Do you see trends as well toward this whole walkable communities?
I definitely think there's more of a trend, and a lot of it is nostalgia. It could be. I mean, a lot of us have reminisced about the old neighborhoods that we grew up in, and where you could
ride bikes to places.
Yeah, where you could ride or you could walk and you could run down to the corner grocery store and get a loaf of bread or whatever. And so there's definitely, you know, people that are trying to recreate that. And plus, I think people want to get out of their cars and, you know, be able to walk to places rather than have to drive places.
Well, and that's kind of what Virginia Place in Northside is, where CityRama will be held this year. It's just a very short walk from the downtown business district of Northside. So you can walk to those great restaurants and shops that are down there already. You know, Northside's just such a great happening place these days that we're really looking forward to a great show there.
And if people want more information about the CityRama show or any other show, can they go
to
your website?
They can go to CincyBuilders.com.
For BusinessWise, I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney. We're with Cooney, Faulkner & Stevens, your business advocate.
I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney.
And this is BusinessWise. Our guest today is Denise Ferguson. Denise is the Senior Vice President for the Cincinnati USA Regional Chamber, and she's leading the Chamber's Economic Development Initiative. And Denise, you're fairly new to our region. What drew you here?
A lot of things. Coming here from Michigan, also in the Midwest, but very attracted by some of the new strategic opportunities here in economic development. We have a new strategy in this region and in the state that we're all very appealing. But the community itself and all of the assets that Cincinnati has that I felt I could come and help really promote and grow on a greater scale.
What's the new strategy that you found appealing?
The new strategy is really all around cluster-based economic development and really focusing on the greatest assets in Cincinnati. So one in particular that was attractive to me, having a strong private sector background in branding and retail and marketing, you have a lot of that here in Cincinnati.
It really does seem like we've been able to recently focus on, you know, what we're good at, what are our strengths, and then how do we capitalize on those?
Sure. And that's exactly what the strategy is, actually. So in that cluster, sort of a combination of different industry sectors that drive consumer branding and product development, we have a lot of that with the pillars, with Macy's, with Kroger, with Procter & Cowell, and so on. Also on the agency side that are developing brands for, you know, most companies and global companies around the world, but also a new strength in data analytics and really understanding where art and science meet there in that arena. So the first step in all of it to get in front of that and do better is to bring all of those people together. And that's the idea of clustering, is really agglomeration, bringing all of those company leaders together with all of us in economic development and otherwise. And a big issue for Cincinnati is to tell the story. We've had these assets for a long time. And, you know, the irony in it is the great brand community hasn't really put its brand out there. And so that's part of what we're trying to do.
What's the goal? Is the goal to have those companies grow larger and create more jobs, or do you want to attract more companies like them into the region?
Yes to both. So part of the idea is to help those companies grow larger in all of the aspects of that. Part of it is to attract new companies and new talent into the region in that space. And then also, there are multiple other clusters where we have strength. So we'll be working with leaders on our team to grow each of those clusters, but we'll also use the brand development and the consumer products cluster to take some of those principles and work across all of those other companies, banks, banks are consumer-facing, insurance is consumer-facing, and utilize some of that expertise to make those clusters stronger as well.
So, Denise, you said something a moment ago that I think is just right on. We have so many assets that we can really shine, and that's what I think you're trying to do.
Absolutely. And, you know, one thing that's wonderful about the Chamber is that we're directly linked to Agenda 360 and through that Vision 2015 on the Kentucky side and all of the strategic efforts and specifically the Story Project. Because even outside mm-hmm. of the key clusters, this is a fantastic community that's beautiful and has all these wonderful resources. So we can blend all of that together and put out a really compelling message, I think, for people that when you say Ohio, and quite frankly, when you say Cincinnati often, what we have here is not the impression that is conjured up in their minds.
So have you seen any results of these efforts yet, or is it still too early?
It is not too early. We have seen our most recent measurements that we're looking at are Q1 11 to Q1 12, and our numbers across all things. So our pipeline of projects is up by 400%. Those are our opportunities. The closed projects that we work on are up by, I think, even slightly more than that.
400% or more. That's fabulous. Denise, we're out of time today, but if folks would like more information about what's going on at the Chamber, where can they go?
CincinnatiChamber.com.
For BusinessWise, I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney. We're with Cooney, Faulkner & Stevens, your business advocate. I'm Tom Cooney.
And I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And this is BusinessWise. Today, our guest is Denise Ferguson. Denise is Senior Vice President of Cincinnati USA Chamber, and she's in charge of the Economic Development Initiative at the Chamber. And Denise, I know you've done a lot of work with a new strategy, or at least a relatively new strategy, around clusters. Maybe you could tell us some of the successes you're experiencing in that area, and maybe even some of the companies that you're attracting.
Absolutely. Yes, we have had quite the effort in the region of really bringing together all of the key players in the private sector and otherwise around some of our key areas of strength, manufacturing for sure, finance, insurance, and IT, consumer branding and product development. And we're bringing leaders together and doing a lot of good efforts to grow those companies and bring new ones in. So a couple of good stories that popped to mind initially, one in that consumer products and brand development cluster, Dunnhumby, you know, a global leader in data analytics that is really working with Kroger and other companies to understand consumer behavior and drive greater results.
And just to emphasize that point, Dunnhumby started here back in 2003, 2004
Correct.
With four people.
Right.
And now they have hundreds of people getting ready to make a big investment downtown in a new building. So that's a great story.
And they are almost at 500 now. And with the full growth over the next 5 years in the new location, they'll be at 1,000. Very smart, you know, analytical people. And the fact that they're coming downtown and co-locating in an area that has a lot of our brand agencies and so on is really going to help us. You know, that's some of the idea of cluster-based economic development.
And so why should people care? I mean, obviously, in addition to the jobs, why should people care about what's going on in our city in terms of economic development?
I think, you know, it's all about prosperity at the end of the day. And as we get smarter about these clusters and drive growth in those clusters, we're going to drive a lot of jobs. We're going to drive a lot of overall economic development. We'll help all of those companies that are in the region. The more people we have coming here, the better. Specifically around some of these flagship clusters, if you will, like brand development, as we tell that story globally, we will be attracting in great talent and increasing our talent pool as well.
How does Jobs Ohio tie into all of this?
Very well, actually. So at the same time that we were developing a new strategy for the partnership, the state of Ohio was as well. And it's very similarly focused around key clusters, so greatest areas of opportunity. It's also focused, as our strategy is, around growing your own. So really ensuring you're focusing on the strength of the companies you have.
But I have had people say they don't like the idea of helping fund companies because it's like the state or communities picking winners.
You know, I would say with this Jobs Ohio effort, actually, you know, it is moving more in a direction away from that. There certainly are programs out there across the country that do that. Jobs Ohio and our effort is really about broadening the entry point, right? The idea of both our strategy and Jobs Ohio is to take a much more holistic and partnership approach with the companies and work on everything, whether it's talent, customer acquisition, whatever it is, to help the companies be strong.
And it's working, isn't it? We're seeing big results.
Yes, that's absolutely true. It is working very well. We had a very good year last year with total job growth. We had the highest in the state. We were higher than national averages as well. In fact, Cincinnati created more jobs than Cleveland and Columbus combined. All that said, across Ohio with this effort, we are creating a lot more jobs. And one of the wonderful things about it is all of the regions are working very well together and syncing up to an overall statewide strategy that makes Ohio more competitive.
If people would like information about some of the things you're doing, they can go to the Chamber's website, CincinnatiUSA.org. For BusinessWise, I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney. We're with Cooney, Faulkner & Stevens, your business advocate.
I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney.
And this is BusinessWise. We are delighted to have as our guest today, Mike Michael. Mike is the president and CEO of Fifth Third Bank here in the Greater Cincinnati region, which really expands to a lot more than just the Greater Cincinnati area.
We go from Lima, down well into northern Kentucky. We cover the entire trade area of this broadcast.
You have not always been at Fifth Third, but yet you started your career in banking while you were still in school.
Yeah, I started in my sophomore year, as I somehow, for some reason, knew that I wanted to be in the banking business. What a tortured existence. And I say that tongue-in-cheek. I started as a teller at the Stanford campus branch of Wells Fargo Bank, one of the best jobs I ever had. Probably met every student on campus at some point.
So you started in college, and you've worked your way up, certainly. You clearly are now, like I mentioned, the president and CEO of Fifth Third. You've been presidents of other banks, yeah. Big banks, too, here in our region that are located here in our region, but not headquartered here in our region.
That's right, and that's a real difference. It was what brought me back into the industry that I found so alluring. We have, of our almost 22,000 employees, 7,000 of them are based here in the greater Cincinnati area. And that's a wonderful thing, because our people are so actively involved in the community. Hundreds of thousands of hours that they give to various community causes, but also the combined efforts of our employees, our company, and foundations that we manage gave away in 2011, invested $8 million in various organizations, over 200 organizations in our community. We're very proud of that. And
as you should be.
Well, that's the sort of thing that a headquarters bank can do, I think. I was stunned one day, before I joined Fifth Third, when I was walking through Fountain Square around lunchtime, and looked at the number of people wearing Fifth Third pins who walked out and went into the stores and into the restaurants, and just how much Fifth Third means to the vibrance of downtown Cincinnati, let alone Dayton and the other communities, northern Kentucky, the other communities where we do business. It's a big deal, and it means a lot to those 7,000 people and the other 22,000 around the country.
Do you feel a heightened level of responsibility being the local head of that organization?
I sure do. Yeah, it's my job to do whatever I can to make sure that the company is advancing the cause of the community, and I'm thrilled to do it, and I have great support from all those people and also from our parent company, which, of course, is located right here.
For BusinessWise, I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney. We're with Cooney, Faulkner & Stevens, your business advocate. I'm Tom Cooney.
And I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And this is BusinessWise. Our guest today is Mike Michael. Mike is the president and CEO of Fifth Third Bank of Greater Cincinnati. And technology has affected virtually every business, and certainly banking has long been affected by technology, from a processing standpoint, and really a lot from a consumer standpoint. What are some of the new things that technology has enabled you to reach out to your customers with?
Technology, as you were asking the question, I was thinking back to my days when I started as a teller in the Stanford campus branch at Wells Fargo Bank. you know, at a walk-up window, and not that many years ago, I took my wife out to show her where I started my career, and it had been replaced by a machine. And I recall, too, that there used to have to be a bank on every corner because the technology was such that we couldn't communicate as rapidly as you can today, and the consumer was limited to whatever hours the bank's open. Now we see advancing technology. For instance, we have introduced recently mobile banking. Just recently also, we developed what we call the Fifth Third Duo card, which grew out of listening to our customers, the curiosity thing, who told us, you know, I'm tired of carrying a debit card for my ATM and a credit card. Why can't I do it all in one? Good idea. So we created that for them. You know, we created for our retail customers what we call the cash recycler, which gives those customers the ability through a machine that we house in their particular place of business to bank their cash right there on site and get credit into their account, and you don't have to deal with couriers and the potential for crime. So technology gives you the ability to do all those things and more.
Well, it's neat because it's technology that allows your customers to save money.
Exactly. Yeah, that the cost of doing business with mm-hmm. a bank has declined.
And time. That's
right.
A big deal.
And you can bank, of course, through the web or through your smartphone 24/7.
Yeah, I want to switch gears just a little bit because another initiative and something that certainly is our passion, I know your bank has embraced this as well, is a whole concept of financial education. You've joined in partnership with
Dave Ramsey, for one.
To go into the schools and help children learn financial education, basic
right.
financial skills, which are so badly needed in our society.
Yeah, it's really very, very important, and it's the part of responsibility that we think is so important around education to prepare our young people for the world that they're about to graduate into.
Do you feel like that's you're seeing results from that? Do you feel you're getting a lot of positive feedback and so forth?
Yeah, we think so. A lot of it will depend on how the particular teachers mm-hmm. introduce the curriculum. But there's been a lot of traction at a number of schools, and we're very pleased with that.
For BusinessWise, I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney. We're with Cooney, Faulkner & Stevens, your business advocate.